This content is issued by Zeus Capital Limited, which is authorised and regulated in the United Kingdom by the Financial Conduct Authority for designated investment business and is a member firm of the London Stock Exchange. Nothing in this podcast should be viewed as investment advice. Listeners should consult an investment professional before making any decisions regarding topics mentioned in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not of Zeus. Please note that participants in this podcast may have financial interests in the matters discussed. Hi, I'm Nick Searle, a member of the Zeus Equity Sales team and host of A Different Perspective. Here we interview interesting characters from the world of business and finance and uncover a different perspective. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts or contact me at live@zeuscapital.co.uk. It's Thursday, 22nd of February. With me today I have Judith Batchelor, OBE. Judith has a background in retail at Marks & Spencer's, Safeway, and 17 years at Sainsbury's. Judith is now Director of Food Matters and also recently appointed Chair to 2024's best performing IPO, Microsalt. Judith, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me on a rather wet and grey day in London.
Very wet and very grey, yes.
Can we start with a bit of your background?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very rural environment in Hampshire, in the New Forest. Yeah. I had a very privileged, actually, upbringing because I lived in a small village community where my mother taught in the same village school for 37 years. So it was a very stable and caring community and very close to nature, obviously.
So were you in the forest or by the coast?
Right on the edge of the forest near the coast, yeah. So about 5 miles from the coast, yeah. But I suppose I grew up in an environment where expectations were, you know, you've got a good education and you worked hard and you went off to be a professional person. So I thought I was going to be a doctor and didn't get the grades at A-level and ended up studying biochemistry, which I love to this day. And my love of nutrition came from that. But I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. So I went and worked for a pharmaceutical company in research for a year. Didn't like that. Because my family are all teachers, I went back to university and did my postgraduate certificate in education and at the same time a diploma in design and taught for a year and didn't like that much either. Yeah. So I found myself applying as a management trainee with Bass. Mm-hmm. And in those days, who were a brewer and a winemaker. Cool. And they put me on a 2-year wine diploma. So I had the privilege of learning everything about wine. And that's where I found my real love of food and drink and indeed my rural background, a love of farming and nature and the countryside. And that's what I've done ever since. So I moved from beers and wines to chocolate at Mars, where I met a lot of my peers that have been quite influential in my career to date. And then to Marks & Spencer, Safeway, and as you say, Sainsbury's. And now I run my own business, but I also do a lot of work for government. So I'm deputy chair at the Environment Agency. I am on the board of one of the research councils for the government, the Natural Environment Research Council, and I'm a trustee at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, which, as well as being a lovely Royal Botanic Garden, is actually home to 450 scientists that are researching plants and fungi and all the secrets that those plants and fungi hold, which is fascinating science. And my strange sort of left field one is that I chair the Rugby Players Association, which is the official trade union of professional men and women players.
How did you come to do that?
I've always loved rugby. It was the Freshers' Week at university, it was very clear that most fun was to be had with the rugby club socials. Love of rugby came from that. And my entire family love rugby. So it's one of the things that we do narrow and deep, as I would say.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then how did the switch to nutrition, how does that fit within all your...
Well, when I was studying at university biochemistry, and I'm going back a long way now to the sort of late 70s, what was emerging as a very new science, and not many universities did it, but the university that I was at did, was nutrition science. And people used to be quite sniffy about it in the fact that they would talk about it as being home economics and it's not a proper science and it's not a proper scientific discipline.
How the world has changed.
How the world has changed. And all the things we know now about our gut health and our microbiome and our...
And how could fungi is for your microbiome.
Exactly. I've always thought that it was the most fascinating science and it's still emerging. So, because it is still relatively young science. And that has just stayed with me. So whenever I look at a plate of food, I look at it from a kind of, you know, that looks gorgeous. It looks like it's going to be tasty. But I'm also thinking about what's in it and is that going to be good for me?
Yes.
Which is, you know, it's pretty fundamental, really. And we realize now how important it is with the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic, the heart disease epidemic that is facing, you know, developed countries.
I mean, we already are killing ourselves with this standard American diet.
Well, today, what was it yesterday, that the House of Lords have now got a committee that's been set up to investigate the obesity crisis and the challenge of ultra-processed foods. So you've got people like Chris Van Tulleken and Henry Dimbleby really campaigning hard on this now. And because the National Food Strategy wasn't implemented, and the strategy that Henry Dimbleby wrote, which is actually brilliant. And if the top tip, if you haven't read his book, Ravenous, it's the best book that's ever been written.
With Chris's book.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Ravenous is a bit like Chris's book, but it's the best book that's ever been written on the food system, definitely.
Interesting. I read Dr. Spector's book.
Yes. Yeah.
That was very good. And I guess it's become more and more topical.
Yes.
Because the NHS can't really fund these chronic diseases, which...
Oh, there's a massive bill to the taxpayer with all of this. And if you were to look at the business case, it is absolutely a no-brainer from a business case point of view that... When you look at the cost to the National Health Service and also, you know, productivity and more generally the GDP of UK PLC, because we've got 12 million people now on long-term sick and therefore unavailable for work. And yet we've got, you know, crisis where people can't fill job vacancies.
I'm playing devil's advocate here. How responsible are the grocers in this ecosystem?
Well, that's a really good question. They are responsible because, of course, they edit what we have on the shelves, to the choices that we make. And you can edit those choices in a way that some people would call a nanny state. Mm-hmm. I would not describe it as a nanny state. I would describe it as a caring society.
Yeah.
That if you know that these foods aren't really good for you and there should be eaten in moderation or rarely as a treat, then you wouldn't be promoting them in the way that they are promoted. And you certainly wouldn't be advertising them to children, because we know from all of the scientific evidence that, you know, you develop your dietary preferences very young.
I mean, and his book talks about his daughter eating a chocolate rice cereal, careful what I say, and how that sort of then develops her mood throughout the whole day.
And we know that, you know, for most of those foods, the real nutritional value in them is very limited, even if they are fortified, artificially fortified with, you know, vitamins and minerals, which of course is what most breakfast cereals are. And of course, when you look at the packaging and they talk about, you know, the goodness that's in there, of course, it's served with milk. So a lot of the goodness is not in the breakfast cereals. It's per serving served with milk. So, you know, you'd be better off just drinking the milk.
And then is there an ability or an argument that, I mean, sadly, fresh fruit and vegetables are very expensive. And a lot of the population, I think, would struggle to spend money on that. Is there any way that that could be subsidized, or is there an ability to tax something to repay for good form?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. So if you look at the way that the government subsidizes families, the two main areas, one is free school meals, and of course strong nutritional guidelines have been developed for school meals, but not necessarily implemented as well as they should be. So there's
Jamie Oliver tried his best.
So there's that, which, you know, probably needs to be relooked at and to be reassessed and to be implemented well. The other thing is a thing called Healthy Start vouchers. And they are vouchers that are given to families that really are on very, very low incomes. I mean, I think the threshold is £7,500 a year income. And those Healthy Start vouchers can be used for infant formula and for fruit and veg, so for healthy things. And there is a sort of myth that families on low incomes don't eat healthy food, but they do, if they've got facilities to cook and prepare food. So one of the things that has been done, and several of the supermarkets have done this, is use their loyalty card data, and they can see if someone is using a Healthy Start voucher, and then they can disproportionately invest in that basket. So when, for example, you double up the value of the Healthy Start voucher for those customers and on fruit and veg, funnily enough, they spend it on fruit and veg. So all the evidence is there. There's some fantastic work being done at Leeds University on this. So the mechanism's there, the data's there, the mechanism's through. Every retailer's now got a loyalty card scheme. And you could very, very easily invest in those families that need it most. And Leeds University created a whole index from multiple data sets called the Priority Places for Food Index, that essentially you can go down to postcode level and look at where families are most vulnerable in terms of their food.
That is very interesting, because it's becoming more and more apparent that what we eat, or the less ultra processed foods we eat, the healthier we should be.
And that's not just physical health, that's mental health as well, because the links between the gut and the brain and, you know, people's overall well-being are now well established.
And I guess also those very rapid sugar spikes from ultra processed food delivers a craving and an anger, and it's also those quick release glucose rather than long release glucose, which you would get fruit and veg and from pulses and beans, etc., I think would make the world a happier place, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And there's some, with my Q hat on, some really interesting research on some of the plant chemistries, because plants, we talk about plants and we talk about basic nutrition, so proteins, carbohydrates, vitamins and minerals. But of course, the real stars in plants and fungi are the phytochemicals, the plant chemicals, and they have got some fantastic properties, including the ability to be able to flatten that glucose curve. So, you know, and again, some of this research is still a lot more to be done, but definitely eating the right plants in the right combinations can basically, stop those sugar spikes.
It's interesting. I had no idea that Q had 400 scientists looking at this. It's normal, actually. And I guess there's been a bit of I think backlash is the wrong term. But 3 years ago, actually, I think it's pre-COVID, 5 years ago, a number of very well-known plant-based businesses floated in the US, beyond meats, etc. And there seems to be a little bit of a backlash, because ultimately, although they may look and taste like the product, they are incredibly highly processed. And actually, there seems to be a turning against that, and it's more whole foods, realizing that actually it's almost healthier for you to eat the meat than it is the plant-based alternative.
Yeah, and the way they are processed is pretty extreme. So if you take something like a soya protein chicken nugget, which, I mean, I can't imagine why anyone would want to eat that, but people have. The way that is produced is the soya beans taken, it's processed, the protein is extracted to create a soya protein isolate that is basically then reconstituted with other things to stick it back together with flavors and salt and other things to look like a piece of chicken. And the greenhouse gas emissions involved in that processing, because it's quite this solvent extraction, it's a pretty highly chemical engineering process, the energy involved in that is greater than some of the equivalents of just eating, you know, real food that resembles something that has grown.
I do find it very bizarre, isn't it, that those who choose not to eat animal flesh don't mind eating the products that look like the animal flesh products. That's the bit that I find rather peculiar, you know, a burger or a chicken nugget.
Yeah. But I think if you look at what's happening in the market now, those products are disappearing, and what are coming to the fore are just much more wholesome whole foods. Yes. So things like chickpeas, lentils, butternut squashes, all those kinds of, and they are delicious.
And they're also relatively cheap.
Yes. So, crikey, yeah. Yeah, they are.
But, and I think that that's very important, especially as we're all feeling the squeeze of the cost of living.
Yeah.
That the meat substitute, rather than a fungus-based meat substitute, beans and lentils can be very much you know, as good a substitute.
Yeah. And again, a lot of the research that's going on is in that space around, I think there are something like 7,500 edible plants. And as a, you know, species, we eat very, very few of them.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Spector says we should eat 30 different species a week.
Yes, so, yeah.
And there's still a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, I always tell people this because with my research hat on, we're looking at a National Potato Innovation Centre, which sounds dreadfully dull, but it's not, because there are actually 80 different species of potato, but we only grow one of them with all the varieties.
Oh,
so
yeah,
so whether it's, whether it's a Jersey Royal or whether it's a rooster potato or whatever it might be, they are all the same species. They're just different varieties. But there are another over 70 species of potato that we don't even know anything about. And potato is actually quite interesting from a phytochemical point of view.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in a potato. I know, it's difficult to imagine, but there is.
And then if we put your environmental agency hat on, what are the main focuses for the agency, or main, what's taking most of your time at the moment? What's the biggest concern?
Yeah, so most of our time in New Woolwich is extreme weather and the challenges that extreme weather brings, and whether that is flooding and what that means for, I mean, London, typically surface water flooding was never anything that we really worried about, or sewage outflows because of flooding. So there's the flooding side of it. There is the drought side of it, which is yet to come. And particularly if you're a farmer and you're relying on abstracted water to irrigate your crops, you know, what happens when those bans are put in place and you can't irrigate your crops?
Yeah, farming today on Monday, I had an interview with a guy who had 2 meters of water in his fields and his lowland.
Yeah.
I mean, his crops were obviously completely ruined.
Yeah. Well, the government is investing a lot in, and this will be a new one, paludiculture. So paludiculture is basically growing crops in wet, boggy land. So imagine sort of paddy fields with rice.
So we're going to become rice manufacturers, rice growers.
So we're now investing in what kind of crops can be grown in flooded land, because a lot of those lowland areas, and particularly lowland peat areas, because peat, obviously, there is a big argument to re-wet lowland peat areas to stop the carbon escaping. What could you grow in those? So Somerset was famous for willow. There's a limit to how much willow you might need, but there are other crops that can be grown. And DEFRA is investing money in looking at that.
I mean, obviously, with all the data, extreme weather has obviously become more paramount over the last 20, 30 years. Is that right? Or are we seeing a greater interest in the extremes? So I guess it's the polarization of hotter summers and wetter winters. Is that right?
Yeah, wetter, warmer winters, hotter, drier summers. I think what no one really imagined was the extremes of the extremes. Okay. So everyone shows you a graph on climate change and the Paris Climate Change Agreement and 1.5 degrees, and they show this sort of straightish line, which is true. Averages, you know, move in that way. Mm-hmm. But the extremes around that straight line are much more extreme, and acute than people predicted, which is why we're getting some of this really strange weather. And historically, the way that the weather is modelled is based on history.
Yes. Yes. And backward looking.
Yeah. So you say, how did these sort of weather systems and you model things and make predictions? But of course, the more uncertain the weather is, the more difficult it is to model. And therefore,
I guess you have
difficult
more,
to predict.
And you have more extreme events then because they're not modeled. So technically, is artificial intelligence able to assist with that yet?
I suspect so. I don't know enough about that. But of course, artificial intelligence has to learn mm-hmm. on data.
Yeah. And it's learning it has on extremes. That's the different to get your average or your mean, isn't it? If you've had a lot of extremes.
But AI works on learning from past data.
Yeah.
And then working out what might happen in the future. And that's the bit that's quite tricky.
So it must be very difficult for the agency in that case on a similar
thing. Yeah, and I think the other thing is that the way the Environment Agency works is it's both a regulator, mm-hmm. i.e. We basically manage the regulations, whether it's water, air quality, whatever it might be from an environmental point of view. But also we are a operator of flood defences, Thames Barrier, those kinds of things. So we've got two hats on, and the uncertainty of climate affects both of those things. So when will we need a new Thames Barrier? And what will happen to other flood defences?
So how do we stop the water companies discharging?
Well, they are allowed to. So the regulation allows them in extreme events to discharge, because if they didn't...
Yeah, it would flood. Yeah.
And that would not, you'd have lots of very unhappy households. But the big thing that's going to stop that is infrastructure investment. So things like the Thames Tideway Tunnel,
yes,
which will be operational very soon, will essentially take all of that. But those are massive infrastructure investments, mm-hmm. a bit like the Thames Barrier, mm-hmm. and therefore you need to make those investments.
Yes. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of money around at the moment.
No, and I think one of the things, if you look at other countries, there are two things. One is they use a lot less water per capita than we do. So if you look at water availability going forward, we're probably using about 150 litres per person a day.
Really?
We should be using about 110. So how do we get people to use less water? Because availability is going to be key. But obviously then there's the quality of the water and everything else that goes with that. And that does require investment. And in other countries, people pay more for their water. It's just as simple as that.
I always feel I pay quite a lot for my water already, but...
Well, I suppose it's all relative, isn't it? Compared to energy or other things,
no,
it's relatively small.
And it is an incredibly, probably finite's not a word, but it is a resource that needs to be managed.
Oh, without water, there's no life on Earth. Yeah. So quality and availability are really important for all sorts of reasons. And the less available water is, the harder it is to manage the quality of it.
Yes, yes, I understand that. And then if we turn the conversation to Microsoft, obviously a recent IPO with which you're chair, what attracted you to Microsoft?
Well, I have to say, having a background in food and working within the food industry, I think I've been working on salt reduction targets along with calorie reduction targets, fat reduction targets since the early 90s.
I mean, we can talk about hypertension, but it is the silent killer ultimately.
Oh, crikey, yeah.
And there are stages and steps that people can do to reduce their blood pressure without having medication in the initial stages, of which reducing salt and alcohol intake and diet and exercise being four of the main ones.
Yeah. And it's no coincidence that the government want to reduce the consumption of foods that are in high in fat, sugar, and salt, the sort of HFSS foods.
Yep.
and have set targets for that. But those targets aren't mandatory. And the reporting against those targets that companies, big corporates, whether they're manufacturers or retailers, have to report against, that's all voluntary. So, you know, people don't necessarily report, and the reporting isn't standardized.
Yeah.
So funnily enough, none of those targets have been met. So we're on the fifth round of salt targets in the UK. The 2024 targets aren't going to be met, and on salt or indeed on calorie reduction. And we know what the consequence of that is. And I suppose if you look at what happened, so the first government targets were in 2001. And actually for the first 15 years, quite good progress was made. But since 2015, there's been very little progress. And in some areas, it's gone backwards. And I think that's a factor of two things. One is this was managed by Public Health England. Mm-hmm. Public Health England no longer exist, and I don't think anyone's really owning those targets. And I think everyone thinks the Food Standards Agency should own those targets and that reporting. And the second reason is actually the taste compromise.
Correct. Yeah.
Is too much for consumers, so they reject those products. And I've been on the receiving end of being too ambitious with salt reduction, and basically customers just stop buying the products. So the reason Microsalt's so brilliant is you can deliver half of the sodium, but no compromise on taste, just because of the particle size, which is, you know, a really simple idea, but brilliantly executed.
And I guess also with Microsalt, it not necessarily for your fish and chips on the table, but the big winner is for commercial use.
Yes. So most of the salt that we consume is in the foods that we...
Our ultra-processed foods.
Or even simply processed. I mean, you think about olives, they're a classic. I mean, they are very salty. A lot of that is for the sort of preserving process, but also for the flavour. But there are lots of foods that use salt in quite high levels that could reduce the salt. And of course, these things are all additive. So lots of small changes make a big difference.
Well, exactly right. They're all marginal gains.
Yes, yeah.
So, and again, bread, of course, has an awful big salt.
Yeah,
salt
breakfast content. Cereals.
I mean, that's staggering, actually, isn't it? There is an awful lot of salt.
Yeah, Microsalt works really well in bread.
Yeah.
Yeah, really well.
And and they're on the cusp of hopefully dealing with some very large multinational companies. So there is pull for their product. Mm. And I guess without government, I think the consumer is becoming more wary of such things, I think. So therefore, to have reduced salt products but also have the same flavour profile as the original, I think should see a decent uptake.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, again, most of this, the salt we consume, comes from those products that we purchase that we haven't made at home. That whole, what I've described as stealth health, is actually most of the gains that have been made in improvements to the diet in the UK, i.e., removal of trans fatty acids, because they don't really exist in products in this country. All of those things have been done by stealth. They haven't been through customers making active decisions. I bought that product last week and it had this much salt, or it had this in it, and I bought it this week and those things have been reduced and I haven't noticed the difference. And, you know, that's a sad admission, but it's the reality. And of course, we have to do a bit of both. We have to get people to make healthier choices, as well as provide them with healthier foods where we can. And obviously, Microsalt helps you to do that.
No, that makes an awful lot of sense. And how often do you have to hang out with the rugby contingent?
Well, in the rugby season, a lot. I mean, work that we do falls into a couple of areas. One is obviously being the official trade union of the players.
I had no idea that the rugby players had a union.
Yeah, so it's like the professional footballers, the professional cricketers. Yeah. There's a sort of, not quite a federation, but there are a number of players' unions that work together and share notes, as it were. And again, all these sports are all professional. They're still pretty much at the infancy of their professionalism.
Yes.
And therefore, all the things that you would expect in corporate life are still evolving.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it's maternity policy or paternity policy.
Yeah. So it's processes and
all of all of those sorts of things we need to put in place and to make sure the game is, you know, fair and equitable and all those kinds of things. And then the other bit is the real duty of care to the players. So whether that's their physical well-being, their mental well-being, or their financial well-being. So when, for example, the rugby clubs all went into administration, so we had Worcester Warriors, followed by Wasps, followed by London Irish. Then we had Jersey Reds in the Championship, and then Worcester Warriors Women. When those clubs go into administration, then there's no one there to pick up the pieces apart from the Rugby Players Association. Yeah. So we've had a very busy 2 years looking after 400 players that found themselves on a Monday morning with no job.
Hmm.
And everything that goes with that. So some of them were injured. Some of them were going through, you know, rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. Some were at the end of contracts. Some, you know, it was a mess, really.
Sounds like good work.
It's certainly worthwhile work and very much needed, actually. Yeah.
Now, Judith, as my regular listeners know, I like to close with three questions, so I'll take one at a time.
Yes.
Your greatest inspiration or mentor?
My greatest mentor was my boss at Marks & Spencer, a lady called Linda Shepherd. And she was one of those people who, first of all, cared enough about you to tell you the things that were difficult to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So what other people might have said about you, what you didn't do quite so well, but in a very caring way. And I've never had that since, actually, that I care enough about you to, because it's people forget it's difficult for the person giving feedback to give feedback that's not great, as hard as it is for the person receiving it. And she was just brilliant at that. She was also one of those people who, because she was a fairly senior woman in an age where women didn't reach senior positions, she was very clear that there were loads of things that were wrong for her that she was going to make right for the people that work for her. And one of those was maternity leave and the ability to come back to work part-time. So I'm going back to the 80s now. Mm-hmm. You went on maternity leave. You didn't go on maternity leave for very long because people would just say you weren't committed to work. And then when you came back, you were expected to be full on, you know, 5 days, 6 days retailing, seven days a week. And she got me a fabulous maternity package. And I came back to work part time. I had twins.
Yeah.
And it was overwhelming, to be honest. And I came back to work 3 days a week for 5 years. And I was the first senior woman in Marks & Spencer to come back to work after maternity leave part time. And she made that happen because she said, I missed my boys growing up.
Yes.
And I don't want other women to have to go through that. And there aren't many, I have to say, women who look after other women in that way, because quite a lot of them have had a hard time getting to where they get to. And that doesn't make them particularly generous with other women. And that's a gross generalization. But she was fabulous. And I still see her today. And I say to her, I credit you with everything. Because if you hadn't looked after me like that, I'm not sure I would have been able to cope.
And I guess then that plays it forward as well. Because no doubt you took that ethos to your other employees and to your other companies that you work for.
I think, you know, women looking after other women is important, definitely.
And then a book that has inspired you. You can have more than one.
Oh, good. I've got several, actually. There's one, it's a real old classic, and I go back to it every time I need a bit of re-energizing, and that is Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Yep. It is just a classic. And you know, there are certain things in there that always click with you. So things like seek first to understand before making yourself understood. things like habit number 7, which is sharpening the saw, you know, and you know, how do you stay sharp? How do you stay energized? And I just love that book. I think it's my go-to if I'm thinking I need a bit of recharging. I go back and revisit it. There is a fabulous book called Remarkable Creatures by Tracy Chevalier. She wrote The Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah. She's a fabulous author. She's also a fellow ambassador at the Woodland Trust.
Is it?
And her husband was a trustee at Kew Gardens, and she loves nature. And Remarkable Creatures, she writes historical fiction, but very well researched. And Remarkable Creatures is all about Mary Anning, the fossil hunter from Lyme Regis.
Okay.
And the fact that she discovered all of these amazing dinosaurs and. But of course, the way that was interpreted was all these Victorian
yes.
plant hunters,
yes.
animal hunters. She sold the fossils to them, but they all ended up in the Royal Geographical Society and the Natural History Museum as discoveries of all of these Victorian men.
Yes.
Not of Mary Anning.
Yes.
And so the story is about her and everything else. But of course, Mary Anning now has her own room in mm-hmm. the Natural History yep. Museum and is now credited with all of those wonderful creatures. And I suppose the other interesting part about that time was, obviously, it was Darwin and theories around evolution, yes. the challenges with the church and religious yep. beliefs. So it's a really... any book by Tracy is brilliant, but that is a brilliant book. And then my third one, sorry.
You have as many as you want, Judith. As you can tell, the podcast loves books. So,
it's a pretty topical one, actually. It's by a lady called Suzanne Simard. She's a Canadian researcher, comes from a British Columbian logging family. So his generations of families working with the forest.
Is he?
And she's written a book called Finding the Mother Tree. And it's all about how the trees communicate underground. And her research originally was rubbished by the academic community as she was sort of outcast as a mad person.
Yeah.
And of course, now we know all of this to be true. So the story of Finding the Mother Tree is about her story and her challenges and, yeah, and where she is today. It's a fantastic, and it's very readable mm-hmm. as well as being the science being really quite compelling.
I'm going to add that to my list. That sounds exceptional. And then finally, what piece of advice would you give to a young person starting out on their career?
Oh, trust your intuition. If I had a pound for every time I tried to, my sensible head
yeah.
tried to rationalize and persuade my more intuitive head
yeah.
that I needed to, I don't know, reassess something. I probably hadn't done a good job the first time round, and trying to persuade myself that something that intuitively didn't feel right was the right thing to do.
So your gut's important.
Yes.
On many levels.
On many levels.
Not just yeah. keeping you healthy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Trust your instincts. They rarely, rarely let you down. And I think that's a confidence thing that comes perhaps when you're older, but genuinely, there are things that I think, gosh, you know, I should have just trusted my instincts.
And then, Judith, how can listeners get in touch with you?
Oh, LinkedIn
and yeah.
Social media. I'm quite active on those things. And if you are on LinkedIn, you'll see I've got quite a broad set of interests, everything from rugby to United Nations Environment Programme and everything in between. So, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know how you find time to do anything else. Judith, that was actually fantastic. Thank you very much for being so informative.
No, it was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to A Different Perspective, a Zeus podcast. If you'd like to feature on the podcast or get in touch, you can contact me on live@zeuscapital.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.